So we make our way further out into what's called the Christmas octave, which means it begins on Christmas Day, the 25th, and ends on another solemn holy day, January 1st, the Feast of Mary, the Mother of God, or the Feast of Circumcision in its kind of old language. And so smack in the middle of that octave, every year the church asks to pray about the mystery of the Holy Family in Nazareth, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. So it's usually on the weekend, or when there's no weekend, on the 30th of the month. So that's what today is. It's the church's intentional pause in the whole Christmas mystery to highlight the fact that in the mystery of the Word made flesh, of Jesus born among us, he chooses to be born into a family. And therefore, the family of Nazareth and the family in general is elevated for our prayer, our contemplation, and reflection as a very privileged and important vehicle that God uses to further humanity and to save humanity. So the family is at front and center today, the Holy Family and our families. So what does that mean exactly? The scriptures give us something of a portrait of this. Every year we get a little different slice or image of the Holy Family. This year it's Matthew's take, and it centers very much on Joseph and his journey to Egypt and back, so that's going on. But in addition to that, the book of Sirach, first reading Old Testament, gives us a beautiful ode to family life in the ancient world. And St. Paul, second reading, gives us sort of a how-to of how to live in a family, either that of the home or of a parish community, both of which he was talking to back in his day. So all that together, the feast day of the gospel, these readings give us this picture of what God and the church wants to think about today, about what family is, what it means, and what it's for. So what can we say about it? It's a huge topic. And today, in our current culture, just like was the case once upon a time in ancient pagan Rome, how we understand family as Christians has become, again, very, very different than the culture understands family. So the message of the feast day is more and more controversial in our current world, like it was once upon a time before everything was Christianized and, you know, Christendom in prior eras. So it's a big topic. You can write an essay, right? So a couple of things. First of all, I guess, to start with, what the scriptures tell us and what revelation and biology confirm is that family has a structure to it. And you could almost think of something like a physics problem. Physics is all about forces or bonds or directions or whatever it is that kind of pulls and hangs things together in the world, in the physical world. So physics is about how things are wedded to each other, you might say, and forces that move in different directions. The readings highlight for us that a family is something of the same. There are different movements, you might say, that bond a family together, different forces or motions. So the first one, and the readings pick this up, and we know this from our life, is the bond between husband and wife. So one man, one woman, who enter into marital covenant forever, that's a bond of union between the two. Marriage exists to unite a man and a woman together, physically, emotionally, spiritually, prayerfully. Things are shared in common in beautiful and exclusive and profound ways, so there is a tremendous bond within a family between husband and wife, and there must be for it to succeed. Joseph and Mary, beautiful bond between them. Their marriage is, of course, unique, it's true, because who Mary is and who Joseph is, but nonetheless, the scriptures are clear that they loved each other very much, sacrificed for each other, helped each other, and placed at the center of themselves God's covenant. Sirach, same thing about husbands and wives, and St. Paul, husbands and wives. He speaks of how they defer to each other, how they help each other, sacrifice for each other, and hold the other one up all the time and put the other's best interests ahead of their own. So that's very clear in our readings. So that's force or motion number one, let's say. Husband and wife together, toward each other. Second sort of motion or movement or force, again, think physics in a family structure, is parents toward their children. Parents toward their children. So the natural order of the world is that that's biological. God blesses many married couples with new life and new children to bring forth. And perhaps it doesn't work out that way, then there is adoption, so there's a spiritual way to do it as well, too, depending. But in both cases, parents are oriented to kids. That's the emotion in a family that is critical. That's, again, in the reading for today, especially the gospel. We have Joseph presented for us, and something happens to him which is really very interesting. God says to Joseph in a dream, look, I know you're settled here in your home, and you have a job, and you have a people, and a religion, and a culture. And God says to Joseph, I want you to uproot all of that and move. go across the desert for weeks at a time, a weeks-long journey across harsh conditions to a foreign land, a foreign people, a foreign language, a place that once upon a time Egypt was hostile to your people, so you're going to go into a strange place all for the sake of who? The child. Protect the child. Protect his mother. Joseph, that is your job. Nothing is said about how he figures it out, how he gets a job, how he feeds them. He just goes. And then once he's there, probably for a few years he's there, God says, okay, now go back. All for the sake of who? The child. The child, the child. He gets back. God says, don't stay here. He's not safe. Go north into Galilee for the sake of who? The child, and his mother. So Joseph's whole existence is oriented for the good of his child. St. Paul, similar concept, and Sirach, similar idea. Parents, provide for your children. Love your children. Do not provoke your children, it says. This is critical. In our very progress-oriented world, in a very productivity-oriented world, in a very commercialized, economics-driven world, unfortunately, one thing that's really kind of happened, and it's more and more the case with every passing year, is that we have, I would say, radically undervalued this movement in family life. One of the most important things that parents can do, in fact, the most important thing I would say that parents can do, is raise up children for the next generation. What a tremendous job. What an undervalued job. What a lofty thing to have to do. And we can be good at lots of things. We can be proficient at medicine, at science, at engineering. We can make things in the world and do projects and have ideas. And all that's great, and the church blesses that. But the church says, you know, the most important thing you can ever do, besides all those cool projects and occupations, is raise up a new life. The next generation relies entirely on parents. And how do you do it? You sacrifice everything. Just like Joseph. Your whole lives are all about who? The child. So it's a critically, critically important movement in the family that parents orient their entire life toward raising up the next generation. That's an undersung thing these days. And God says for the future of humanity, it's the most important thing anybody does, raise up tomorrow so they can succeed on their own. And then you die and they come on the scene and then they die. This is how the world goes on. Raise up the next generation, God says. Protect them and help them to become proficient. So that's very important. Another movement, so we have spouses toward each other, spouses who bring forth children and orient their entire life to raising them. Another movement is for children toward their parents. So the bond goes in reverse, too. This is another motion in the family. Sirach picks up on this especially, but as does Paul. They say, obey your parents, kids. Take care of your moms and dads in old age. Don't write them off. Don't dismiss them. Don't make fun of them. Tempting as that may be sometimes in life. The fact is, parents are not disposable, dispensable, and you get a long life if you honor them, God says. You must look after and obey and respect your elders. This is a critically important movement in the family and out of the family as well. There's a bond between siblings. That too is in there, implied in the readings. So there's that motion, held together by biology and by a household. And lastly, most importantly, at the middle of all the motions, so between spouses, toward kids, toward parents, siblings among each other, at the middle is God. All the bonds go back to God. He is at the center of the family. The Holy Family, look at again the gospel. What is it all about? Between Mary and Joseph, their union is centered on who? The child between them, who is God. He's the linchpin of their household. So therefore, God is at the kernel of family life, period, period. So that is, long story short, the structure of the family. One man, one woman, married for life in a covenantal bond to bring forth new life if God blesses them with it, to orient their lives to raising up the children, who in turn take care of their parents, who in turn take care of each other, who are all centered on God. That's the structure, the fundamental structure of family, as shown to us in our readings today, verified by biology and by the rest of divine revelation. Now, what follows from that? Well, a whole bunch of stuff, obviously, right? And I'll try and contain this to a few points out of thousands. First of all, it's no small thing that God chooses, I mentioned this in the beginning, to be born into this structure, God looked at the world and said, I'm going to enter the world, and I'll do it through a family. Family, in that structure I just described, becomes, therefore, a privileged vehicle through which God enters the world. Family life sanctifies. Family life is the chief way that God uses to perfect us, grow us, move us forward, challenge us, inspire us, break us open, redeem us, save us. Good enough for Jesus to live in a family, good enough for all of us. So by choosing Nazareth and a home, God says, I choose family life for myself. I will bless it from the inside out. So it's not accidental. It's essential. It's indispensable in God's plan of salvation. It also means we can break out from this, too, that the family structure I described, that the church lays for us in the scriptures, is what's called, I would say, it's normative and it's intentional. It's normative and it's intentional. So what does that mean? It's intentional, let's do that one first, because it doesn't happen by accident. There's no such thing as accidental family. I mean, saying a family happens kind of by chance or something that's random is the same thing as saying I'm going to cut down a tree and expect it's going to land in a nice stacked wood pile. It doesn't happen that way. It takes work and effort. So therefore, those bonds of family, which while they may be based in biology, they're maintained by choices. Hundreds of little choices every single day that every member makes to maintain the structure. You can't just accidentally be a family. You must choose it over and over again. Parents choose each other. Parents choose kids. Kids choose parents. Siblings choose each other. And that means I sacrifice. I put my needs behind somebody else's. I can live and go without if I need to. I will elevate others. I will be generous. I'll be loving. I'll be kind. Choices, choices, choices. And if the choices don't follow the structures weaken and they come apart. So the intentionality of family is critical. And the church raises this feast day up every year to remind us that we all have to choose to maintain the structure in all of our lives in very important and sacrificial ways. It's not a piece of cake, but it is, in fact, essential for our well-being. It's also normative. And normative means it doesn't allow for variations. There's no alternative models to this, which is popular in our current cultural discourse. So normative means that there's a little variation allowed in the sense that maybe, you know, you adopt instead because you can't have biological children. That's within the bounds. Spouse dies, remarry, within the bounds. Adopt your cousins because their parents are gone, whatever, within the bounds. The church has recognized a little bit of room to move within this model. But there's a certain point, though, where if you go too far out of the structure and try and change it, it's no longer the acceptable pathway of God's plan for the family. It's too far out of the norm. There is a set template that you can't mess with too far, otherwise you crash the whole system. It's normative because God entered into it. It's normative because biology requires it. It's normative because the scriptures highlight it and they reinforce it. And as people, we believe not only in biology, but in divine revelation, the scriptures which show us these things. So that means that's why we understand that certain variations that the culture talks about these days do not fit in the structure. To the point where, no matter how well-intentioned somebody else is to try and make another model for this, we'd say it's not going to work. It can't work. It's not in God's plan for family or married life or for humanity. And therefore, we reject it. So the church is not being judgmental when we say, for example, that we cannot bless same-sex unions, that we cannot let same-sex couples have and raise children, that we cannot use contraception, mutual fertilization, all the hot-button things that we talk about in marriage. The church says all those teachings exist because a family structure is sacrosanct. You can't mess with it. And if you do, it weakens everything. So it's normative and it's intentional, because God has blessed it as the structure he has made his own for the sake of humanity's future. And if we change it, we don't have a future as humanity anymore. It's as simple as that. That being said, where does it leave people whose family is kind of a mess, which is frankly all of ours, let's be honest. Every family has its own mess. Things do fall apart. Things do break down. We know what the norm is. We all want it. The fact that we're all sad when we don't meet the norm tells us the norm is true, and we know this. Therefore, experience validates revelation and biology. Nobody rejoices when things fall apart. That tells us the norm has a hold on our hearts for a reason. It's normal for a reason. So, but what do you do when it doesn't happen? God still helps. God still works. God still does whatever he can to save. All that is true. He doesn't just toss us off because we're not fitting the model. However, his work to save is always to steer us back toward the norm as much as he possibly can. Not to make an alternative structure and bless it as valid. That is not the way of divine revelation. God works in anything that we throw at him, but he works to bring us back to what he intends for humanity over and over again. So he abandons nobody, nobody, but he always tries to push us back to what he knows is best for our future, which is the model that I have laid out from Revelation. It's a lot to lay out there, right? But it is true. It is true. Last little piece, and I'm done. How does one maintain all of this stuff? So here's the structure. It's intentional, which means we've got to choose it by choices every day. It's normative, so you can only fudge on it only a little bit before you get really out of whack, personally and culturally. How do you maintain it? Well, certainly love. In the physics problem, what are the bonds that hold us all together? It is love. And love has nothing to do with emotion at its core. It's all about choice. It means I intend God and good for somebody else to elevate them. If it was only emotion, we'd all be done. That doesn't last. But choices do, and they're made over and over again. And because love is a choice, God can command it of us. He can't command emotions, but he commands choices. So love, of course, is the bond of it, but expanding from that, forgiveness. Families are held together by mercy. Can you imagine how awful it would be in a family if nobody ever said they were sorry or forgave somebody else? It'd be a disaster. You couldn't go on. You couldn't function. It would be over. So in the heart of the family is the cross and resurrection, in the humility of saying, I messed up, and I need to grow, and I need to change, and maybe somebody else was right. All that maintains those bonds. It's critical. That's why God gives us so many teachings on mercy and forgiveness and second chances. Because as he's patient with us, we are patient, hopefully, with each other. And lastly, to maintain a family, right, love, mercy, prayer. If at the center of the structure is God, then it makes total sense that a family requires prayer to stay together, too. So we pray together as a household, meal prayers, nighttime prayers, but we also pray as individuals. It's not enough to just say have a public prayer. Each of us in a house must have a personal connection to Jesus that is all our own. So we go to bed at night or get up in the morning or we go throughout our day. Spouses pray together, but they pray separately. Kids pray together, but you pray separately. We all have to have our own personal way in a household of bonding with Jesus who is at the center of the household. Otherwise, it's not going to work and it's not going to last. So end of essay. Point is, this is, as the church says it, gospel. It's good news. The world hears us today and gets all upset that we're being judgmental about structures and processes, and the church says, no. God has given a very confused world a light that shines on the proper pathway that leads to our happiness and leads to the future and leads to a new generation of humanity to continue. It's an act of hope in the promise of tomorrow. So God says, don't get mad at it. Embrace it. It's hard, of course. But I entered into it in Nazareth because I believe God says that this family structure that I created is the best way to save all of you. So have hope in it, take delight in it, do the hard work of it, and we've all got it. I got my family work to do too, we all do. And believe God says that through all of that, I'm actually saving you, perfecting you, sanctifying you, building you up into better persons and a culture and a world. The family is his part of his plan to save humanity. That is not oppressive news, it is the best news if we choose to follow it. It's all about choices, right? And this is stuck smack in the Christmas season because the church wants to remind us that the child in the crib brings choices. To follow Jesus means to live as he lived, that includes in a family, and that requires choices, which he makes possible in his grace from the cross to strengthen all of us to live up to the bonds that we have entered into out of obligation to those who we love and who love us in return. It's actually a beautiful picture, even if challenging. It's the way forward. May Mary, the Blessed Mother, and Joseph pray for us that we will take these truths in, live by them, rejoice in them, and not be ashamed of them. And when things go awry, we'll run back to his mercy and the cross to bring us back together again. God can fix and mend anything when it's done according to his plan. So we entrust our families and homes and hearts and selves to him and to the child Jesus anew to celebrate the Holy Family and our family that he wants to make holy in his sight.